You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Julie Burstein. I'm in for Leonard Lopate on this beautiful Friday afternoon. In a recent article in The Nation called The Wrong Kind of Green, Johann Hari writes that the relationship between some notable American conservation groups, corporate cash, and legislation may be tainting the principles of the green movement. Mr. Hari, who has often taken contrarian approaches to issues ranging from legalizing drugs to the Dalai Lama, argues here that there's no room or time for compromise on issues relating to climate change, and his criticism has ignited a lot of controversy. He's a columnist for The Independent in London, which is where he joins us from, and a contributing writer for Slate. Johann Hari, welcome to The Leonard Lopate Show.
Hi, Julie. Good to be with you.
Thanks so much for being with us today. I don't know, is the weather as nice in London as it is here in New York?
The weather in London is kind of what it always is. It's kind of overcast. You think maybe there's going to be sun, but you know it's not going to happen, really. If it comes, it'll come for like 2 minutes.
We're lucky here in that the sun finally came out. At the beginning of this article, you write about how you've traveled the world and you've witnessed how global warming is remaking the map of the world. What have you seen?
Well, I've been to all sorts of different places. The most shocking for me was actually to go to Bangladesh. It's the most densely populated country in the world, and it's also the lowest-lying country in the world. And it's pretty extraordinary. When you go to the coast there, people will point to the middle of the ocean and they'll say, oh, do you see that little chimney sticking up? That's where my house used to be. And you say, all right, when did you leave? And they'll say, oh, 6 months ago. You know, the really rapid sea level rise that they're seeing, because it only takes relatively small sea level rise to wipe out huge amounts of Bangladesh, is quite startling. And actually, even when you go like 100 miles inland, you find these villages where they're just in this bizarre state, because about 10 years ago, all their trees died. They didn't understand why. Then all their rice paddies died. Then their animals started dying. Then their children started getting sick. Then they started getting sick. And, of course, the reason why is because seawater is rising in below the land. So it's killing all the plant roots. It's contaminated the fresh water that they need to rely on. So, you know, you get it somewhere like Bangladesh. I went to the Arctic, where the figures are just staggering. Since the year I was born, 1979, 40% of the Arctic summer ice has just gone. It's not there anymore. It's an area bigger than Texas and California that's just disappeared. On the current trends, I will live to see a time when the North Pole is a point in the open ocean that you can reach by boat. Or, you know, another place, actually, a very different place, is Darfur, where when I went to the borders of Darfur, you talk to the refugees crossing over the border and you say, well, how did this all begin? And they're very clear. They say, well, we got on all right until the water dried up. And then we killed each other. We started killing each other for the water that was left. That's actually the view of the UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, has described it. That is the primary cause as well. So it's kind of weird for me because I've spent so much time reporting on the effects of global warming. And obviously when I was in all these places, I imagined that people like Conservation International and the Nature Conservancy, the Sierra Club, kind of had my back, you know, had the back of all these people who were being killed, were, you know, campaigning to reduce the emission of warming gases so that, you know, these crises abate. And it was pretty shocking to go to the Copenhagen Climate Summit and find that, in fact, they weren't doing that. In fact, these groups were, at best, lobbying for, like, way suboptimal positions and cheering them on as great, like far, far short of what the climate science requires, or at worst, actively proposing programs that were environmentally harmful and that would accelerate global warming.
Let's take a look first at this figure of 350. You focus a lot of attention, as was focused in Copenhagen too, on the need to lower carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to 350 parts per million. How, from what you've seen, how might that be accomplished? What is it that you're looking for to happen in order to be able to achieve that?
I think it's important to say this is not my view. I'm a journalist. This is the view of the world's climate scientists, who have an absolutely rock-solid and overwhelming consensus. It's as strong as the consensus that smoking causes lung cancer or that HIV causes AIDS. And people should be aware, when you're being told that's not the case, that's a very powerful corporate lobby that are saying that. Now, obviously, we all desperately wish global warming wasn't happening. Nothing would make me happier. But man-made global warming, but obviously it is. This is demonstrably the case. The oil companies who make a lot of money out of burning fossil fuels are funding a program of systematic disinformation, which people, you know, your older listeners will remember exactly the same thing happened with smoking. For a very long time, we've now got the internal documents from the smoking companies. They said that even though they knew that smoking caused lung cancer, they said their job was to manufacture doubt, to create the impression there was a scientific controversy when there wasn't, and so on. Exactly the same thing is happening now. So this isn't my view, this isn't some contrarian view. This is the overwhelming view of the world's scientists. And virtually all the scientific, well, in fact, all the leading scientific academies of the world say that there is an overwhelming consensus about this.
And so, that, yes, that is true. And yet there are so many people who doubt this and who are, in fact, more and more people are, perhaps because the picture that's painted is so scary, it seems that a lot of people are trying not to listen to it.
And one thing to say about denial is, it's natural, it's instinctively odd to be told that an odourless, colourless gas can cause the sea to rise and the weather to change. That instinctively seems odd to us, but there are lots of other things that instinctively seem odd. The idea of vaccination, when it first came in, seemed to people insane. What, you're telling me you're going to give me the disease so that I stop having it? Now virtually everyone gets vaccinated because we know that although it's counterintuitive, it's also true. So there's an element of denial that is just a perfectly natural, what is this? I don't understand. But, you know, that wave of denial, we should all have gotten over by now, these facts. It's been known that carbon dioxide is a gas that traps heat in the atmosphere for over 150 years. It's been known for a very long time that increasing it would eventually have effects on the climate. And really, the science is absolutely overwhelming. The alternative explanations that are given by deniers, so for example, they say, you know, there's a variation in the sun's output, have just been proven to be wrong. There is no relationship between, there hasn't been increased output from the sun. These things can be measured in the period in which we've had global warming. So, you know, the alternative explanations just don't hold. This explanation is very clearly the case. You know, there is a warming gas in the atmosphere, and we are massively increasing it by burning coal and oil and gas. And the analogy I always use is, you know, imagine you were about to get on a plane, and a coalition of all the world's airline engineers came up to you and said, you know what, don't get on this plane. We've looked at the plans, we've looked at the mechanics of it all, and it's really not safe to get on this plane. And then another group of people, employed by the people who own the plane, who are journalists and plumbers and have never worked in the airline industry, never worked in building planes, don't know anything about aeronautics, come up to you and said, you know what, get on the plane, don't worry. It's obviously rubbish what these people are saying, get on it. Virtually nobody would get on the plane. And I think we're in a similar situation now. The balance of risk, even if you have doubt, the chances that all the world scientists, all the world's climate scientists, are just wrong and totally 100% wrong seem to me pretty slim. And, you know, it's not impossible, but it's highly unlikely. And the sensible thing to do is to make the transition that they're recommending. And it's worth bearing in mind, the transition they're recommending is something that we would want to do anyway. A, oil is running out. B, we have to get oil overwhelmingly from these really disgusting regimes that we then fund, who then wage propaganda and sometimes literal war against us, like the Saudis, who are one of the biggest funders of jihadism anywhere in the world. It leads us to fight these horrific wars in places like Iraq to try to, you know, retain our control of the oil supply. So it puts us in hocks of dictatorships. It means we have to engage in these horrible wars, and it's going to run out anyway.
And so what are the barriers then? Why would people then say, let's not go to this figure of 350 parts per million, which is something that the scientists focus on and you focus on, to lower carbon dioxide in the atmosphere? What would make it so difficult for us to do that?
Well, I think there's several things. One is there's a very small number of incredibly rich and powerful people who profit from the ongoing system. Obviously, the people who control the oil and gas supply and coal are incredibly rich, and they will lose a lot of money if we make an immediate transition to powering our societies by the awesome power of the sun and the wind and the waves. They'll lose a lot of money that way. And so they're deliberately misinforming everyone, trying to change the terms of the debate, trying to make us think it's not a problem, or you know, it's some incredibly distant problem, which it isn't. So, you know, that's basically how it's working. And they're deliberately underplaying the consequences and the warnings that are coming from scientists. And, you know, it's easy to spread disinformation about this. For example, one of the primary goal at Copenhagen, which the world's leaders shamefully failed to meet, was that we've got to stay within... We've got to prevent global warming going any higher than 2 degrees centigrade. Now, instinctively to people, that sounds like, 2 degrees centigrade, what's that? If I go out for a picnic and the world gets, you know, and it gets hotter by 2 degrees centigrade, you know, what do? I take off my shirt. You know, it doesn't bother me. What people need to understand is that analogy, which is being put out by deniers, is completely flawed. If you go out to a picnic and your body temperature goes up by 2 degrees and it doesn't go back down, you'll die. The planet is much more like your body than it is like a picnic. What sound like relatively small changes in global temperature have a huge effect. We are currently only 6 degrees away from the last ice age. We are currently moving in the opposite direction incredibly quickly. The upper end of predictions for global warming that we could experience this century, so certainly in the lifetime of a child being born now, or probably in the lifetime of a child being born today, given the increase in life expectancy, is that that child could face a world that is 6 degrees warmer. Just people to understand, and I know this is shocking, but this is, people can check this out, this is a scientific fact. The last time the world warmed that rapidly by 6 degrees, it actually took 10,000 years. That's what was considered rapid in the past, the planet's paleoclimatological past, was 251 million years ago. And the result of that 6-degree rise was that almost everything on Earth died. The only creature that remained on land was a pig creature called Lysotorus that had the Earth to itself for another 50 million years. So, you know, a 6-degree rise that may not sound like much in a day-to-day. A 6-degree rise globally is an absolutely astonishing rise in global temperatures. And that is the upper end of what we could be facing. So it's really important for people to understand this is not, you know, this is not a trivial issue.
Well, I think people, many people grasp how ominous this is. But I think, as you just described, it's hard when we live our lives and walk outside. And as I said at the beginning of this segment, you know, it's a beautiful day. It's going to be 70 degrees Fahrenheit here. Everybody is happy. It's hard, I think, for many people to grasp the enormity of this. So your description right now of our own bodies and what would happen if we went up 2 degrees, that I think does help people understand the...
But also, Julie, you asked a question I didn't completely answer, which was you said, how do we make that transition? Actually, if you compare it to the challenges that were faced by my grandparents' generation, for example, they're relatively minor sacrifices. For example, here in Europe, if we covered 1/1000th of the Sahara Desert with solar panels, which is technology that already exists, could be done, it would power the whole of Europe indefinitely, like literally indefinitely.
Hmm.
And that's including if we all had electric cars and plugged them all into the grid. Now, that's very expensive to do, obviously, but once you've done it, you've saved a fortune and you've forestalled this horrific future scenario.
Do you know what
the United States has a huge amount of deserts. Sorry.
I was going to ask, you said that's hugely expensive. You know, so is what was just proposed, which is prospecting for oil in our oceans.
Mm. It's expensive, but my God, it's not as expensive as is even as the Iraq war on its own. You know, and we're going to have to do that anyway. The oil is running out, you know. We're going to have to do that. The question is, do we do it in 40 years when not only have we depleted all the oil, but we've irreparably damaged the ecosystem, or do we do it now?
And so the question, it sounds like, is not so much self-sacrifice, that perhaps we need to turn our lights off more, or if we can afford it, buy electric cars. But it is also, or perhaps more importantly, where do we get this energy from?
Well, it's really important for people to understand the solution to this does not lie in changing your shopping patterns, or not primarily in changing your shopping patterns. You know, there's a campaign here which is trying to get people to sign, a very noble, well-intentioned campaign here that's trying to get people to voluntarily sign up to cut their carbon emissions by 10%. You know, I don't begrudge the people who are doing that, but the analogy I always use is people saying, oh, I'm changing my shopping, I'm buying less. It's like it's 1937 And everyone worried about the rise of fascism is going around signing a pledge saying they personally won't invade Poland. Well, thanks very much for that, but someone's going to have to go and stop the people who are invading Poland. And in the same way, 10% of nice people buying slightly greener goods, you know, isn't going to make any difference because the people who are still doing this terrible stuff are going to carry on. If everyone who spends their time obsessing about changing their shopping pattern to make it very slightly greener dedicated all that time and all that money and all that energy to joining Greenpeace or joining 350.org and politically campaigning so everyone has to change their shopping patterns, they would be spending their time much more effectively.
I'm speaking with Johan Hari. He has written an article for The Nation called The Wrong Kind of Green, and it's about environmental groups that accept donations from some of the world's biggest corporations. It appeared in the March 4 edition of The Nation, and we'll be back with more after the break. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate today, and I'm speaking with the journalist Johan Hari, who has written an article called The Wrong Kind of Green that was in The Nation last month. Now, Mr. Hari, in this article, really what has raised a lot of hubbub is your criticism of the way that climate change is being addressed by some of the large environmental organizations. What are your main criticisms, and can you talk about just a couple of the groups that you look at?
Yeah, just to be clear at the start, though, there are some absolutely superb American environmental groups, Greenpeace and 350.org, Friends of the Earth, who are not involved in any of this, who are doing brilliant work, and I urge people to support them. Now, separate to that, there is a group of so-called environmental groups who are in fact being funded by the world's worst polluters and have developed a model where they are systematically funded by the worst polluters. And I think the evidence is pretty clear that in return they have either watered down their positions on global warming or actually, in several instances, supported false solutions that make the problem worse. This actually began in the 1980s that a few groups cottoned onto the idea that, oh, well, maybe we could ask Shell or BP to fund us. Now, you have to just think about this in any other sphere.
Well, it's interesting because in other spheres, I work in public radio, and in public radio, we often take underwriting and public television also. I remember a controversy in the 70s when, 70s, probably later than that, 90s, when Archer Daniels Midland was in a lot of trouble and funded a lot of things on public radio and public television. But we in our industry have firewalls between the people who handle the underwriting and the people who handle the content. So as I read what you were talking about, I had a couple of questions. One was, and maybe you could talk about one particular organization, how much funding are we talking about?
We're talking about a very significant part of their revenue streams and in some parts a majority. Mm. So if you look, for example, at the Nature Conservancy or Conservation International, they are dependent for running a very large amount of their programs on money taken from groups that literally are responsible for the worst global warming anywhere. People who are more responsible for it than any other individuals, groups like Shell, British Petroleum. And there's pretty good evidence now, in fact, overwhelming evidence, that they don't have those firewalls in place. If you look, for example, at someone called Christine McDonald, who worked for Conservation International, she found, subsequently become a whistleblower, she found that whenever she tried to raise the fact that, oh, hang on, why are we praising these groups? There was one plant in particular that was giving them money that had a plant in Texas that was so bad it was actually measurably damaged the air pollution for the entire United States. And they were not only not condemning it, they were actually praising this company and saying how great they were. This was happening time and time again. There was a case where, you know, IKEA, for example, were revealed as using wood that was taken from trees from endangered forests, and the World Wildlife Fund immediately leapt to their defense. Now, and made really big public statements saying, no, IKEA can't be blamed for that. Now, it could be a coincidence that WWF is taking money from IKEA, but it would seem an extraordinary coincidence, and people on the inside, like Christine McDonald, say that what happened was that they in effect became, as she put it, satellite PR companies for the polluters that were giving them money. Now, the polluters are very clear about this. Whenever they're asked about it, they say, William Morris, who's the head of AEP, American Electrical Power, said only, I think last year, in an interview with the Washington Post, well, when people like Greenpeace say we give this money so we can carry on burning coal, you betcha. You know, they're fairly clear about why they're giving the money. And the basic protections that you would expect to be in place, well, I mean, I don't think they should take this money at all. And actually, there is fairly good evidence. I mean, The Independent, for example, is funded by advertising, the newspaper I work for. And there is pretty good evidence that it does, that all of us who work in media that are funded by advertisers, it does have an effect, and it doesn't have the, it's not as blatantly corrupt as this, but, you know, anyone who's read Noam Chomsky's book, Manufacturing Consent, knows how it does sway our agendas in complicated ways and does shape our worldview. Now, this takes that to a real extreme. If you imagine in any other field, if you imagine, for example, that the NAACP was dependent for its continued existence on funding from Rush Limbaugh and the Klan, or Amnesty International funded its human rights reports by taking money from Dick Cheney and the Burmese junta and Robert Mugabe, we would all become extremely suspicious and start saying, well, surely this is going to affect their agenda. Now, there are measurable ways in which it has affected their agenda. One is the climate science is overwhelmingly playing, we need a 40% cut of US emissions by 2020 and an 80% cut by 2050. Now, these groups, the Nature Conservancy and Conservationist National, are not only not demanding that, they're actually supporting systems which make that impossible. They're supporting legislation which puts us on a path to something far, far short of that and calling it a solution. But it gets worse when you look at something, and unfortunately it is quite complicated, but it's really worth people paying attention to this because it is the future of the world we're talking about. There's a program called RED, which means reduced emissions from deforestation and degradation.
And this is about carbon offsets, where you would be able to...
Basically, it's the UN program. When we eventually get a global climate deal, it will be an essential component of it. And it's based on, at its core, basically a trick. When Barack Obama says that the cap-and-trade bill will cause a 4% cut in carbon emissions by the US by 2020, most people will assume, oh, that means we'll have, you know, fewer coal power stations here and more wind farms and more solar power and so on. That's not actually true. If you look at both at the bill that's before Congress and the RED proposals by the UN, what actually happens is they can go anywhere in the world, pay for a cut in emissions, and claim that as an American cut. Now, in theory, that sounds okay. Why does the climate care whether, you know, there was fewer emissions in Wichita or in Congo? It doesn't care. But the problem is you're injecting into the system something that then opens up a huge amount of room for scams. And that's what's happened. So, for example, say they go to, and this is a real case, Bolivia, and they ring-fence a bit of the Bolivian rainforest, and they pay people to not cut it down, right? That sounds like, oh, so there are reduced emissions there. Okay, so then in return, you can keep open this coal power plant in Wichita. But when you go and look at these, for example, the rainforest project in Bolivia that was named, in fact, what you find is it was a total scam. Firstly, if you only ring-fence a very small part of the rainforest, we know what happens. The loggers will take the money to not cut it down and go to the next bit of rainforest along and cut that down instead. Indeed, they actually often use the money they had been paid to not cut down a bit of the rainforest to buy more logging equipment to cut down more rainforest. So that's just one example of how these are illusory cuts that we then, in return, claim, oh, well, if that's a cut, we can now emit more. So what's incredible is the Nature Conservancy and Conservation International, instead of calling out these systems and saying, look, we should be preserving the world's rainforests because we need the world's rainforest standing, period, and we should be paying for that, you know, without any compensatory increase in coal or gas in the United States. That's something we should just be doing as an urgent humanitarian and environmental priority. They have, in fact, been the ringleaders of demanding this trading system, a trading system that is totally broken. And even the premises of the trading system are wrong. So, for example, if you claim to have preserved a rainforest, right, and in return you emit something in a coal power station in the United States, the carbon dioxide that you emit from that coal power station will be in the atmosphere for thousands of years.
Yeah,
so
you wrote
to be comparable,
very nicely about that. Yeah, about you wrote very nicely about that. That it would it would mean Julius Caesar saying,
"You would have to keep the rainforest standing for comparable many thousands of years." But how can we guarantee that? That's like Julius Caesar making a commitment that would still bind Barack Obama. It's bizarre. So the whole thing is based on just basic conceptual flaws. We're not trading like for like. But instead of opposing the system, TNC and Conservationist National are cheerleading for it. And as Amazon Watch, a really good independent group that refused polluter cash, said to me, you know, basically what they're doing is positioning themselves to be the middlemen in a carbon market. What will happen is they will run these small projects, they'll get loads of money running through their accounts, they'll be able to give the impression they're saving the rainforest, when in fact they're supporting a system they know perfectly well will lead to the faster destruction of the rainforest for several reasons. Not only do the loggers then go to the next place along and knock that down, but also, if in return you have increased emissions in the United States, well, then you'll have a lot more global warming. And the evidence is pretty clear that where you increase global warming, places like the Amazon are very vulnerable. The Amazon is a very humid environment. It only takes a very small amount of warming for it to then dry out, and it doesn't have any resistance to fire. So there's evidence that huge amounts of it will just burn down if we have even relatively small levels of global warming. So they're effectively supporting a scam. Now, it's hard. They're smart people. They employ smart scientists. These are not particularly complicated points for environmental scientists to understand. They know it perfectly well. It's very hard to find an explanation for why they would behave in such incredibly destructive ways and support and lobby for such destructive non-solutions, unless you factor in that they're just getting a lot of money for it.
You know, there were a lot of comments in the nation from these organizations, and as I read them, I thought of two things. One, these people do seem very well-meaning, and it does, from what you're talking about and from your article, seem like part of it is the size of an organization. You have, at the beginning, you said that there are a number of organizations who are really working hard to try to get us to that 350 parts per million goal. But all of those are very small, and the organizations that you're talking about are very large. And could it be that the
I don't think that's true.
I guess Greenpeace is not very small, yes, but smaller than these other ones. And
I don't think that's true. I think if you looked at the global revenue and membership and activities of Greenpeace, I think they're bigger than TNC and Conservationist National. I don't think that's right. I don't think this is a question of size. I think it's a question of money. At the end of the day, you know, as Molly Ivins, the great Texan journalist, put it, you got to dance with them that brung you, you know? If the people who bring you to the party are the worst polluters in the world, at the end of the day, you'll dance to their tune. It's very similar to the funding of how you fund political campaigns in the United States. If your political campaigns are paid for by Wall Street and the big health insurance companies and the arms companies, you can't really be surprised when your politicians work for them and not for you. And in the same way, if these groups are paid and funded, whatever the individual motivations of the individual people, if these groups are dependent for their funding on BP and Shell, if the heads of BP and Shell and the other worst polluters in the world explicitly say the reason why they're funding these groups is so they can carry on burning coal, that means these groups are going to dance to their tune.
Could there be influence, though, going the other way, that having a conversation and engaging with the organizations that are doing the things that you need to stop is a way of beginning the conversation to be able to get things to stop?
Sure, but you can have a conversation with someone without taking money from them. I mean, Amnesty International condemns human rights abusers all over the world. In order to have that conversation, it doesn't need to say, oh, by the way, could I have some money, please, from the Burmese hunter? Sure. Of course, there is no evidence that BP or Shell or these very hard-headed organizations have moderated their record an inch. There's overwhelming evidence these environmental groups have altered their agenda.
Have things
But there's nothing to stop you having a conversation. Sure, I mean, I'm all in favor of having a conversation with anyone who wants to have a conversation, but you don't have to be paid to have a conversation.
Are things different in Europe, where you sit? Are things different in Britain, where there are also people who are very concerned about this and organizations
sure,
that are addressing it?
Where wherever there is less polluting money going to the environmental groups, things are better. That's true in the United States, whereas I stress, you know, I don't want people to go out, cancel their donation to Conservation International and not do anything else. Transfer your money from Conservation International to 350.org, to Greenpeace, to Friends of the Earth, to people who are not involved in these corrupt practices. And those groups are fantastic within the United States. In Europe, it's generally not considered the done thing to take money from these groups for very obvious reasons. And one of the things also I think is really important, here in Britain, we've had a really inspirational movement that's risen up over the past 4 or 5 years of mostly young people who have, instead of playing the game that these environmental groups have of desperately praising the Democratic Party, even when it spits in their face, even when it announces that it's going to be oil drilling, constantly saying the Democrats are, you know, constantly stressing the real but incredibly small difference between the Democrats and Republicans on these issues, and constantly saying if only there's another Democratic victory, then somehow it'll all come all right. Instead of that, there were actually very direct movements of young people who just took direct action, just like the civil rights movement. And they've done some pretty incredible things. For example, here in London, there was going to be an extension to the biggest airport in Europe, Heathrow Airport, and they're going to build yet another runway, environmentally disastrous. And these young people went and physically blockaded the places where they were planning to build them. Indeed, they went to the biggest coal power station in Western Europe Drax in Yorkshire, and just physically blockaded the coal trains, would not let them pass. And incredibly, when they were arrested, there was then a trial in which the young people who blocked the train explained that they were acting in self-defense because global warming is a threat to their safety and the safety of all of us. And a jury of 12 ordinary British people acquitted them and said they were right. You know, they called climate scientists to testify. The climate scientists explained it. And the ordinary citizens said, my God, they're right. They should be blockading the trains. You know, and since then, now, if you look at the effects of these corporate groups, they've had virtually no effect. The cap and trade legislation is a disgrace. It's filled with loopholes. They've just been spat at by the Obama administration with this announcement of offshore drilling. Compare that to what's happened in Britain, where there's been direct action, and there's no new coal power plants being planned in this country. It will be very hard to get them passed. The Heathrow runway, which had looked certain, is now basically dead in the water, and Britain has a better record than most European countries. We've still got a very long way to go. We're still very short of the climate science. But that very direct environmental movement has had much more effect than this kind of let's take money from the polluters and, you know, beg them for a few crumbs from their table. We are too late in the day. The crisis is too big to adopt that kind of approach. And I don't think it's really how change has ever happened in America. Well, I don't think that, you know, I mean, imagine if the civil rights movement had been taking money from you know, from George Wallace.
And we're going to need to leave it here because we need to move on. But the description of what's going on in Britain is a fascinating one. And I've been speaking with Johan Hari about his article, The Wrong Kind of Green. It's about environmental groups that accept donations from some of the world's biggest companies. And it appeared in the March 4 edition of The Nation. Thank you so much for joining us today.